It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios, welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You all right?
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
On this day in the year 1918, church bells rang, families embraced, and celebrations, as you know, filled the streets like never before in towns throughout Europe and the United States. But victory had come at a terrible cost. Among the Allied forces, more than 1 million French soldiers and 116,000 American service members had been killed by the war's end. Millions more were wounded. Countless would come home bearing the lasting scars of trench warfare and the grisly horrors of chemical weapons. During the final battle of the war, over 26,000 Americans lost their lives, and more than 95,000 were wounded. It was the single deadliest battle in United States history. Think of that. 26,000 Americans lost their lives in a battle. Here on the revered grounds of Suresnes American Cemetery lie more than 1,500 U.S. service members who made the ultimate sacrifice in the First World War. Among those buried here are legendary Marines who fought in the Battle of Belleau Wood. In that treacherous forest and the surrounding fields, American Marine soldiers and Allied forces fought to turn the tide of the war, and that's what they did. They turned the tide of the war. Earlier this year, President Macron presented an oak sapling from Belleau Wood as a gift to our nation, an enduring reminder of our friendship sealed in battle. We fought well together. You could not fight better than we fought together. Each of these marble crosses and stars of David marks the life of an American warrior. Great, great warriors they are, who gave everything for family, country, God, and freedom. Through rain, hail, snow, mud, poisonous gas, bullets and mortar, they held the line and pushed onward to victory. It was a great, great victory. Costly victory, but a great victory.
That was President Donald Trump in Paris, France yesterday, commemorating what they call Armistice Day, the end of World War I. And of course, here at home, we call this our Veterans Day, where we stop and remember and thank the members of all of our armed forces for their service to our country. In many cases, some of them never came back home. Others bear, you know, injuries that have changed their lives forever. And others were fortunate and God blessed to come back healthy and whole and to reenter civilization and make a difference in the country that they love so much. Sandy Rios with you on this special Veterans Day. And I just want to say thank you to each of you who have served. I want to just say that what I'd like to do today is a little history, because I suspect even as our kids and as the memory of World War II fades from our memory, we see things about Nazis all the time on television, and the kids, our children, our grandchildren know something about World War II, but I sort of think they don't know hardly anything about World War I. So that's what I want to center on today. Let me just say that it was the First World War. It's known as the Great War. It started in Europe in July of 1914. It ended, of course, November the 11th of 1918. It involved 70 million military personnel, 60 million Europeans, an estimated 9 million combatants, 7 million civilians died as a direct result of the war. Genocides came out of it. Influenza pandemic of 1918 came out of it, which caused about $50 to $100 million deaths worldwide. There's a lot to say about it, and I've asked someone to join me this morning who's an expert on war, and he may not be familiar to you in that account, but he is to me. It's my husband, Bruce, whose name last name should go unmentioned, Bruce is a former Federal Bureau of Investigation a special agent for many years, but at the same time, he has always, he has books and books and books and loves to study war. So I've asked him to join us today. Hi, Bruce.
Good morning.
Good morning, dear.
I'm a little overwhelmed by being called an expert.
Well, I think you're
a follower. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I'd say compared to most, you know a lot, babe. So I want to ask you, World War I is kind of a mystery and an unknown thing to us. It started, I remember, this is one of the first things I learned in history as a kid, was that the Archduke Ferdinand was murdered in this horse-drawn carriage in Turkey, it seems to me, and that's what started the whole war.
Yes, well,
or Prussia.
It was in Sarajevo, and actually he and his wife, the emperor and his wife were both in a car, and a man by the name of Gavrilo Princip, who was a Serb nationalist, shot both of them and killed both of them. And that basically started a chain reaction of alliances going into effect because Russia was looking to take over those areas of the world, the Balkans. So they were in an alliance with France and England. And so eventually the three of them declared war, and Germany and Italy was also with the Allies in the first war. And then Germany and the Austro-Hungarian Empire were allies, and they came to the defense of the Serbians, and one thing led to another, which is really crazy because if you've looked at the relationships of these countries at that time, most of the leaders were related either through blood as cousins or marriage. The King of England and the Tsar were cousins. They looked almost exactly alike. They looked like brothers rather than that. The Kaiser was related by marriage to people in the English Empire. So it was really something that I think it's one of those things where people weren't taking a step back and slowing down. Their hubris.
It was their honor.
Their honor and their hubris got a hold of them.
We're pretty clear. Well, most people are pretty clear about what were the causes of World War II, the march of Nazism. But Kaiser Wilhelm was the Kaiser in Germany during World War I. And, of course, the Germans, and you're a German, so I could say this, the Germans were a very warlike people. They loved to fight.
Yes, they did.
What is how did that play into this? I mean, they didn't cause this.
Well, again, it was primarily caused by these alliances that were pledges that if you are attacked, we will come to your defense. Now, that sounds kind of honorable, but there was more to it than that. Germany, I think, was very jealous of the United Kingdom and the colonies that they possessed around the world, and they really wanted to get in on all of this too. And so this sort of gave them an opening to get involved in seeking other territory in addition to just being on the European mainland.
You know, Bruce, having been in, traveled a lot, I've observed that like the Russians, the Germans, the English even, and the French, and there are others, I'm sure, Polish, remember their wars. They remember them. They mark those days. They are serious commemorations. They never forget. I mean, the Russians especially, that this was the war of, 50 years ago, and here we all are marching in the streets about this, and the kids know about this. This is not the case here. So let's paint a picture. World War I had a devastating impact on the world. Can you kind of explain what that was all about? Why was that such a devastating war?
Well, it was really the first worldwide war. And by that we mean it was fought in the Middle East. It was fought, on the European mainland. It was fought over colonies. It was fought on the oceans. It was fought, obviously, on land. And for the first time, it was fought in the air. You have to remember, the airplane was only invented in 1903 here in America. And here in 1914, it's being put into battle.
I mean,
an 11-year evolution to become, and by the end of the war, the airplane was very sophisticated, and so the in regard to the scope of the war, I mean, when you go to Europe now, like say when we were in Scotland, you go into these small churches in these villages, they still have lists of all the people that were killed from their village. 2% of the British Empire, their population was killed in that war. I mean, you think of that, 1 in 50 people died in that war, either through combat or through disease.
And it was a very brutal war, right, Bruce? Because chemical weapons were used for the first time, and there was so much maiming. I mean, horrible maiming.
What happened is the technology had outpaced the tactics. And so, you know, where in like the Civil War times in the Revolution, you used to just line men up in rows and send them towards each other, and it was basically a matter of, do we have more people than you or better position than you? Those tactics were still in play during the First World War, but now we have machine guns, airplanes, chemical warfare, artillery that was massive. And they're sending these men out into what was called no man's land. Basically, it was just a slugfest between trying to gain 100 yards of territory. Yeah. And for whatever reason, the capture of very little pieces of real estate was considered a victory because they were measuring it by, oh, well, we moved the line instead of how many people it costs us to move that line.
Bruce, we just have a few minutes left, and we have to talk about, at least in the minutes we have left, why that war was kind of a setup for World War II. There were unresolved conflicts, and there was treatment of the people that lost that caused such resentment. Explain that.
Yes. Of course, economic conditions really tanked shortly after the war. The Germans in the Treaty of Versailles, which ended the war, the troops were still ready to go with Germany. It wasn't like they were defeated and were reeling in that attack. But what a lot of it was is that the German people at home had been so starved and neglected that they wanted to end this war. And the effects of communism, communist agitators were working on people back home, telling them, you need to get out of this war. And what happened is when the armistice was signed, really, nobody felt like they were defeated. They felt like the Germans felt like they were cheated. And a lot of the blame was taken and placed against Jewish people. And that fomented over the years between World War I and World War II. Countries were created in that armistice that, you know, they're creating a country, but there's no culture there. So you have all these cultures mixed together. They're having a hard time getting along. The French decided they wanted no more of wars like this, so they built this huge defensive line called the Maginot Line, thinking that would keep peace. The League of Nations was developed. That was the forerunner of the United Nations. That was supposed to solve conflicts. They called this the war to end all war. Of course, it didn't turn out that way. All of these things were maybe good in principle, bad in results.
Yeah, because you think about it, then what, 20 years later,
yes,
World War II begins.
Yes.
So it was festering, and so the casualties, was there anything good that came from World War I, do you think? Anything good?
Well, for the United States, it made us a world power. Prior to that, we had sort of been a minor player on the stage of things, and the next thing you know, we're going across the ocean and throwing a million men into the fight, and it really changed the United States.
Could we just say that your grandfather was a soldier in World War I? We still have his full uniform. Just briefly, what did he do?
He was a sergeant, and he went into combat, but we always talk about the pandemic flu. He got the flu and almost died from getting the flu over there. What happened is all these people were together and disease started.
Yeah, so that was your grandfather. And again, yeah, we have his uniform, his full uniform,
sure,
hanging
do
in our home. So it's really something. He was a big strapping guy. So it's
he
kind
was
of in your DNA to be interested in war. Bruce, my sweet husband, my expert on wars, all things war. If you have a question, email me and I'll ask him. Thank you, honey, for joining me.
Thank you.
All right, the Florida recount, the Georgia recount, and all the nonsense in Arizona we'll discuss next with Hans von Spakovsky. Don't go away. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Hello, everyone. I'm Tim Wildman, president of American Family Association and American Family Radio. You know, our tours each year fill up quickly. And so I'm letting you know now, don't tell anybody else now, that the 2019 Spiritual Heritage Tours are planned for June and for September. So if you want to go this year, that is 2019, you need to let us know as soon as you can. Visit the website spiritualheritagetours.com. Spiritualheritagetours.com. Again, those are two separate trips, one to Williamsburg, Jamestown, and Yorktown, and the other one to Washington, D.C., and George Washington's Mount Vernon. Stephen McDowell, who's the president and founder of the Providence Foundation, is our historian, and he'll be on both trips telling us the behind the scenes and the stories of who, what, when, and why.
Hi, this is Ron Ball, and this is your Choose Greatness Minute. I read a fascinating story about the management style of Dwight Eisenhower, president of the United States in the 1950s. Eisenhower told his staff he would never make a major decision after 3 o'clock in the afternoon because, he explained, he was simply not at his best. Sometimes you need to rest to be at your best. Remember that Jesus took time alone. There were moments when he was away from his disciples, when he rested, when he prayed, and God refreshed him physically in his human nature. Sometimes the most important thing you can do is to stop and recharge and re-energize and reconnect with God and his purpose for you. Remember to be at your best. Sometimes it is important that you rest. And when you rest, remember to renew yourself with God. Learn more at choosegreatness.com, choosegreatness.com.
Hello, Americans. I'm Todd Starnes with news and commentary next.
Truett McConnell University.
Hey, my name's Aaron Abbs. I am an undecided major, and I'm a freshman here at TMU. And as soon as I came here, I fell in love with the campus. Like, I knew, like, God was calling me to be here at TMU. And, you know, I couldn't get a better education than this. Like, professors who pray before class, who care about your spiritual walk with Christ. You are who you are, and they care about you.
Are you called? Visit truett.edu today.
A North Carolina State University professor is under fire for providing students with a handout that told them to block Fox News from family members. The handout also accused my network of spreading bigotry and hatred. You can read the document for yourself at toddstarnes.com. The professor also urged white students to stop calling the police on minorities, suggesting they have implicit bias. In other words, if you see something suspicious, don't say anything at all. Just keep it to yourself. This is what propaganda looks like, folks. It's one thing if this professor worked for a private college, but she works for a taxpayer-funded university. You pay her salary. Now, I understand the professor has apologized and the university considers the matter closed, but is that really good enough? Maybe NC State should consider sending a stronger message to faculty that classrooms are for teaching, not indoctrinating. I'm Todd Starnes.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
The machines have been processing ballots, are actually right now not running because they're loading in another batch of ballots, we believe, to be the mail-in votes. But they've been doing it all night long, and really they're not even recounting just yet, guys. Very important. They're getting the first page counted to get a total number of votes because the Governor Scott's lawsuit focuses against Brenda Snipes because they claim she failed to account for the total number of ballots left to be counted. Yesterday, I asked the attorneys for both the Democrat side and the Republican side about Supervisor Snipes. Here's what they had to say.
Brenda Snipes might be under-personed and might have too much thrust upon her suddenly. I don't think there's anyone who thinks she is dishonest or lacks integrity.
She allowed felons to vote. There were 30 of them that came in that people voted twice. If somebody cheats and commits a felony, should their first vote count? I don't think so. I think they ought to strike them all. But it's, you know, welcome to sunny Broward County.
Also yesterday, Florida's Attorney General Pam Bondi sending a letter to the Commissioner of the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, writing in part, "I fail to see how the Florida Department of Law Enforcement can legitimately refuse to investigate where there is reasonable suspicion that may lead to the discovery of criminal actions in the conduct of the 2018 election, actions that gravely damaged Floridians' confidence in our electoral process and democracy." All of this as Governor Scott and Senator Nelson trade vicious barbs against each other. The thing to watch for here, guys, is Thursday, November 15th. That is when the second unofficial votes are due, and these machines working fiercely to get that. If it is indeed a margin still under 0.25%, we go to a hand vote here in Broward County. It's going to take some time. Let's assume that the number of ballots cast is in that 700,000 range. Mm-hmm. The hand count only applies to the over and under votes. We don't know what that number could be. It could be 30, 40,000, but it's certainly going to take a lot of time because they're going to have to determine the intent of the voter.
That was Griff Jenkins on Fox this morning, and this is Sandy Rios back with you. Well, you know, remember that the left loves chaos. That's how they do their best work. They create chaos. And certainly we have chaos in Florida. We also have chaos in Arizona, where Kristen Sinema has moved ahead of her Republican opponent. The votes are still, John Kyle has said, Democrats' legal strategy in Arizona sounds like an effort to disenfranchise voters. Also, out of the Free Press in Detroit, they found that there 248 precincts in Detroit were voted. They found where voting machines tabulated more Election Day votes than people who were counted as they checked in to vote. And then, of course, we have a situation in New Mexico, and on it goes. I've asked Hans von Spakovsky to join us this morning because Hans is an expert on elections, among all the other things he's expert on. He's with the Heritage Foundation. Hans, thanks for joining us this morning.
Sandy, thanks for having me on.
I don't even think I mentioned Georgia, which you know very well. In fact, let's just start with Georgia, because let's just start with Georgia. What's going on there in that recount over the governor's race?
Well, the problem there, as you know, is that Stacey Abrams, the Democratic candidate, is basically refusing to concede, even though Brian Kemp is just above the 50% needed to win. He's a little less than 2 percentage points ahead, and she's refusing to concede because she and Democrats have been making all kinds of, frankly, unproven claims that there were irregularities in the election. There weren't. The big thing that still hasn't been completed is the determinations of all the provisional ballots that were cast. You know, what happens with provisional ballots, those are the ballots given to people who, when they show up at the polling place, there's some kind of problem. Perhaps their name isn't on the voter registration list, etc. And after Election Day, election officials investigate each one of those to determine should that ballot be counted or not. Abrams is actually refusing to concede, even though if she was granted every single provisional ballot that was outstanding, Kemp would still win. So there's no reason, really, I think, to doubt that Brian Kemp has actually won the governorship of the state.
So what do you do in a case like that where a person refuses? I mean, this is what we have, Hans, you know, choose the subject matter. It's lawlessness, refusal to follow the law. So in this particular case, if Stacey Adams refuses to concede, can Brian Kemp just goes ahead and becomes the governor and she just never concedes? Is that how it works?
It does. The only way that there can be any kind of official action to contest the election is if she actually files a lawsuit. And she will have a tough time filing a lawsuit and winning unless she can come up with some kind of major issue that throws the results of the election in doubt. And so far, nothing like that has come up.
All right, so now in Florida, in the same question first, there was a concession by the Democrat in Florida to Governor Scott. He conceded, and then he took back his concession. Do concessions have any legal significance, or are they just courtesies?
No, they don't. And the rule in Florida is that if there's 0.5% difference between the winner and the loser, then there's an automatic recount by machine. And by machine, what I mean is folks who remember 2000 and the punch card machines they use, those are long gone. In Florida today, they use what are called OptiScan ballots. Those are the paper ballots where you mark in a little bubble next to the name, and then they're fed through a computer scanner, which counts the vote. So in an automatic recount, they basically go through and feed the ballots through the computer scanner again to get a machine count. And the only problem they have is occasionally a ballot that somebody has filled out, the scanner can't determine what the vote was. Oftentimes it's because, for example, somebody may have not filled out the bubble, but maybe they, for example, circled the name of the candidate, and the machine can't read that. And that's where you have to do a eyeball hand inspection of the ballot to figure out, well, who did the voter actually vote for?
So they've run it through twice already, as I understand it, and now they, I don't know what they're doing next, but I want to just point out what Senator Marco Rubio tweeted last week right after this happened. He said, the most important threat in elections is Florida. Bay County was hit by a Category 4 hurricane just 4 weeks ago, yet managed to count votes and submit timely results. Yet over 41 hours after polls closed, Broward election office is still counting votes. That was his salvo, his first tweet, and he went on to tweet a lot of other concerns. But really, it boils down in Florida, as we all know, to two counties, Broward and Palm Beach County. And it boils down to two election officials, one of them Brenda Snipes. In fact, let's talk about her. Hans, I'm sure you've studied her record. What can you tell us about Brenda Snipes?
Well, it's no surprise that Broward County can't seem to get its act together, because Brenda Snipes is known throughout Florida as probably the most incompetent election official in the entire state, and also one of the most overtly partisan. She has been found in the past to have done all kinds of things, from destroying ballots in violation of state law to opening up absentee ballots before they were allowed to do so under the law. I mean, she is really incompetent. I have to say, unfortunately, you know, Rick Scott, when he was the governor, he had the power under state law to remove her from office because of her past unlawful behavior. He did not do that, and unfortunately, he's now reaping the effects of not having acted against her when he was the governor.
You know, I want to mention something. Congressman Matt Gaetz, who is from Florida, has been making his presence known at these counting places. And he posted a video last night. He talks about he saw a truck with people loading things, boxes on this truck. And he tried to ask what they were. I'm going to play the video, and then let's talk about that. Let's listen.
Why can't we watch what's going on, man?
We're told you can't be here, so you have to...
Who told you that we can't watch what's going in and out of the truck? Who's your super? Yeah, I would love to see him.
Okay. But until then, let's go.
All right. Well, you tell me why we can't know what's going in and out of that truck. And who? What's the name of your supervisor?
We'll get all that taken care of.
Do you know this? Do you know his or her name? The supervisor's name?
Yeah.
What's their name?
We'll bring them out to you in a second.
Do you know their name?
Yes. We'll
bring them out. What is it? Will you tell it to me?
Bring them out to you in a second.
What's on the truck?
All right, that was Matt Gaetz, and he is a congressman, by the way, from Florida, and they tell him he can't watch, he can't see, he has to get away from the truck. He also tries to enter a place where they're counting votes, and they won't let him in. They tell him it's not safe. He's dressed, he has a congressional pin on, he's got a suit on, and they will not let him pass. I'm just curious, Hans, is there any authority, does a U.S. congressman have authority in a situation like that over local governance?
Well, he doesn't have authority over local governance, but Florida has a state law that allows candidates and the political parties to have observers in watching every single aspect of an election. And what that means is that the Republican Party and its representatives and the Republican candidates have a right to observe everything going on, from the loading of trucks with ballot boxes, to the counting of votes, to the determinations being made about provisional ballots and whether that particular voter was actually eligible and should vote. And the fact that Brenda Snipes and people working for her are not following state law, That is a real problem. The law is intended to have transparency so that nothing untoward can happen in secret. And again, this shows the problems with Snipes, the fact that she's not even following basic state law on allowing observers in.
And just to give some numbers here, my understanding, it's so complex, and you'll have to correct me here if I've gotten this wrong, but my understanding is that you have to have declared how many ballots have come in, I think 30 minutes after the polls close, something like that, in Florida?
Yeah, you're supposed to give a total, and you should know by then because of the fact that the ballots, these paper ballots, they're scanned in the polling places. So each polling place has the ability immediately, when the polls close on election day, to send a report to the county office, the county headquarters, of how many ballots were counted by the computer scanners in their polling place. So there's no excuse except for either incompetence or some kind of intentional wrongdoing for not have those numbers.
And just to spell out what's happening here. My information says that on election night, Broward County said there were 634,000 votes cast. At 1 a.m. Thursday, they said, there were 695,700 votes cast. And by 2:30 Thursday, they said there were 707,223 ballots cast. And by Thursday, they increased it to 712,840 ballots cast. Now, there's been a lawsuit filed, and one that has been won. What can you tell us about the status with those lawsuits, Hans?
Well, I think part of the status of those lawsuits was allowing Governor Scott in to observe the entire process and to take a look at what's going on. And so far, it doesn't appear that Brenda Snipes has been complying with that the way she should. This is an election where the Secretary of State, frankly, needs to be in Broward County supervising what's going on because of all the problems being caused by Brenda Snipes.
Yeah, but how do you, when people are lawless, here we go. When people ignore the law, which they are, it's becoming like a routine. Who's going to actually, like in my mother's words, make them mind? Who's going to make them mind? Who's going to make them actually obey the law? What's the body? Is it courts? What's going to happen here?
Well, this is the area where the courts, if they're ordering Brenda Snipes to engage particular behavior, and then they get evidence that she's not, she needs to be held in contempt, and frankly, they need to send marshals out there to arrest her. And bring her into court. That's about the only way you're going to get her to listen, because she has a history of defying courts, defying court orders, and again, it shows why she should have been removed long ago as being the chief election official for that county.
You know what's here interesting? Because Governor Scott ordered Florida law enforcement, and I'm sorry, I can't recall exactly which body, but he ordered Florida law enforcement to go in and investigate, and they responded by saying they don't have any evidence of wrongdoing. So that's also curious to me.
Well, it is, particularly because my understanding, and I think you played the clip earlier, was that Pam Bondi, the attorney general, who, by the way, is a very good AG, you know, some folks have been mentioning her as a possible replacement for Jeff Sessions. She also has sent a letter to the Florida Department of Law Enforcement. That's basically the equivalent of the state troopers for the state, telling them that she doesn't understand why they're not going in, given the evidence of possible wrongdoing.
Yeah.
And the evidence of possible wrongdoing is the fact that all these ballots were showing up even days later after the election.
Hans, can you hold on? Can you stay with me for a minute longer?
Yeah, I can.
Okay, I would like to finish this conversation. I'd also like to have your input about what's going on in Arizona. And I want to talk about the attorney that's been sent down to Florida to help Bill Nelson and Andrew Gillum, because that's an interesting story, too. All right, my guest is Hans von Spakovsky. This is interesting stuff that will have real impact on this country. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
For we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against spiritual wickedness in high places. My name is Abraham Hamilton III, and this is the Hamilton Minute. Florida law enforcement officials foiled a plot by two middle school girls who planned to kill over a dozen smaller children, eat their flesh, and drink their blood. The 6th and 7th grade girls, ages 11 and 12, were arrested at Bartow Middle School. The girls had several weapons, including a butcher knife, a knife sharpener, and a pizza cutter. When asked about their motivation, the girls said they were Satan worshipers, and they planned to drink their victims' blood out of a goblet they were found with. Warfare, people. This warfare is spiritual.
Listen each weekday from 5 to 6 p.m. Central for the Hamilton Corner. For more from Abraham Hamilton III, public policy analyst for the American Family Association.
Brian Fisher here with today's Life and Liberty Minute. Does the Bible have anything to say about our crisis at the southern border? We get some answers from Numbers chapter 20. Moses brings the nation of over 2 million people to the southern border of Edom and asks for permission to enter. "Please let us pass through your land," says Moses. But the king of Edom says, "You shall not pass through, lest I come out with the sword against you." So we are told Edom refused to give Israel passage through his territory. Did Moses cross the border illegally? Did he try to sneak his people across? Did he rail at the king of Edom for his lack of compassion? No, he did not. The Bible says quite simply that Israel turned away from the king of Edom. Bottom line, immigration is a privilege, not a right.
Catch Brian Fisher on Focal Point, weekday afternoons at 105 Central on American Family Radio. Lynn Ingram of Redeem Clean felt God call him to support the American Family Association.
I'm a laundryman. I'm the son of a laundryman, too. I love clean clothes. I love the business. I love everything about it. This project was built exclusively to support AFA and AFR. There's no strings attached. Another thing that I would like to see come out of this is that I would like to see other business people feel a calling to support ministries, wherever and whatever they do to share the gospel of Jesus Christ.
In addition to your regular AFA giving, Redeem Clean Laundry Detergent allows you to increase your support of AFA just by continuing to wash your family's clothes. For clean laundry and support of a cleaner society, it's Redeem Clean. Learn more, find options, and get Redeem Clean products at redeemclean.afastore.net. That's redeemclean.afastore.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
This is really the whole gang of infamous election riggers from 2016 getting the gang back together for one last caper. You've got Debbie Wasserman Schultz, you've got Mark Elias, and Brenda Snipes. And Mark Elias is really the common denominator with every 2016 election scandal that we saw. People don't really talk about this, but he was the general counsel for both the Clinton campaign and the DNC before Clinton was the nominee. And that really gets to the heart of what they did to Bernie Sanders, is here they were supposed to be running a neutral primary, and they were operating as an adjunct of Clinton's campaign in Brooklyn. And Mark Elias was basically the guy that brought them together. And he had actually laundered money for them, essentially, because when they were doing something super sketchy that they wanted to hide from the Federal Election Commission, they would pay his law firm, but it wasn't for legal work. He would turn around, and then he hired Fusion GPS. And, down in Broward County, they did it to Wasserman Schultz's Democratic opponent, Tim Canova, as well. And that's where you've got, Brenda Snipes. She illegally destroyed ballots for this guy. So these guys are really, Mark Elias and this whole crew, I mean, they're really Machiavellian operators. I mean, it all comes down to him. He's the one who his law firm hired CrowdStrike with the DNC hack. They did Fusion GPS, started the Russia thing. It all comes down to him, and he's going to do whatever he can get away with, and there's nowhere in the country he can get away with more than Broward County. Broward County really is the most corrupt place in the U.S. I mean, you've got their elected representatives are Debbie Wasserman Schultz, whose own party hates her for stealing the election from Bernie Sanders. You've got Alcee Hastings, who was kicked out as a federal judge for taking bribes. You've got Brenda Snipes. Even their sheriff was, remember, the coward of Broward, whose people ran away when there was a school shooting and lied about it. So this is a deeply corrupt place. And at the end of the day, I mean, the question is, do you just have to take the word of Brenda Snipes? And this is a woman who 12 times has been caught being wildly corrupt or completely negligent. Because these are serial riggers, and they got away with it before, and you know, they're going to go on to rig again.
That was Luke Rosiak of Daily Caller, who's been our guest before, you know that. You know what the really creepy thing about what happened in Broward also, just to kind of illustrate how bad this is? You may recall the name Nicholas Cruz, that kid that's accused of killing 17 other kids at the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School back in February. He's in jail awaiting his trial, and he was registered to vote. And he, as far as we don't know if he voted, but he was registered to vote. He was. They went into the jails and registered people that were jailed for various offenses, including the one that he's accused of. Hans von Spakovsky is my guest. I'm guessing, Hans, that you would probably like to expand on that, what Luke Rosiak said about Mark Elias. Mark Elias being the attorney who has been sent down to Florida to save the day for Bill Nelson and for Andrew Gillum. What more can you tell us by way of explanation about who he is?
Well, look, in addition to, and this is very important, Mark Elias being the one who really got the Bob Mueller investigation started at the Trump campaign, here's something even more relevant, more important to why he's been hired in Florida. Mark Elias was the lawyer who was hired by Al Franken in 2008 in the Senate race in Minnesota. And if you recall, the Minnesota race on Election Day, Norm Coleman, who was the incumbent Republican senator, was declared the winner by 700 votes out of 2.9 million cast. But Al Franken, who lost, hired Mark Elias. Mark Elias went to work, and 8 months later, through litigation and, frankly, changing the rules and a lot of other behavior, got the election overturned. And part of what they did, and this is what he'll try to do in Florida, is that when they were looking at absentee ballots and provisional ballots, in Democratic counties, the election officials there would decide to count those ballots even when they didn't actually comply with state laws. So, for example, if an absentee ballot comes in and the signature does not match the signature on record, you're not supposed to count it. But what happened was county election officials bent the rule so that votes would get counted, and in the end, they managed to get enough votes to declare Al Franken the winner.
Yeah, and could I just interject? As I recall, Al Franken was the deciding vote on Obamacare.
That's right.
Yeah. And this Mark Elias also was involved in probably a lesser-known race to people, casual listeners of the news, but Dino Rossi, I think, ran for governor in Washington State and was
right.
Also, I'm alleging, cheated out of his win by this same Mark Elias.
Yeah, Mark Elias is the way to label him is, he's the expert Democrats bring in when they lose a race and they want to use litigation to overturn it.
All right, now I've been reading just from insiders, as you do too, Hans, that the Republicans have sent, you know, some big guns down to Florida. Do you agree with that assessment? Do you think there are some real fighters going into Florida to try to make this right?
Yeah, and I know some of the lawyers who are going down there, and yeah, they are fighters. The problem they have to understand is that they are up against, you know, Republicans tend to want to play by the rules. I mean, that's kind of their philosophy, and they need to understand that they're going up against folks who don't play by the rules and who believe the end justifies the means, however you get there. And they got to understand that in the fight that they're now waging.
Let's talk about Arizona for a second, because that's a little bit more murky to me. Kirsten Gillibrand, no, I got my names mixed up. Kristen Sinema is ahead now of Martha McSally. But I just saw from Martha McSally, her shop anyway, a message yesterday that she doesn't think she's lost yet. It has to do with, for them, it's absentee. I don't know if it's provisional ballots, absentee. Can you help us understand what's going on there?
Yeah, the last I saw, Kirsten Sinema was ahead by about a little over 30,000 votes. That's about 1.4% out of the over 2 million votes cast in the state. But here's the problem and why it's taking so long. Unfortunately, Arizona is one of those states where 75%, if you can believe it, 75% of voters in that state vote through absentee ballots by mail. And so it takes a very long time to go through those absentee ballots and the checking process to do things, for example, make sure that the signature matches the one that you have on record. And that's why it's taking so long, and that's probably why Martha McSally thinks she may still have a chance to win, because they just haven't made it through all the absentee ballots.
Do you think that Arizona compares to Florida in any way over potential voter fraud?
Well, look, in 2004, Arizona, by referendum, passed a requirement that when you register to vote, you're supposed to provide proof that you are a U.S. citizen. And the reason for that was that they were finding non-citizens on the voter registration roll. You know, it's a border state. And they were having a real problem with that. The left went to court and has litigated to prevent that requirement from being enforced. And that tells you that the left wants non-citizens to register, to vote, and to get away with it because they think it will help them in elections.
Yeah. Well, that, of course, is happening in Florida, too, according to what I'm reading. Brenda Snice has been doing the same thing, and the Gillum people have been encouraging, at least in one instance, the vote of someone who's not a citizen. So if we know about one, you know there are others. Let me just ask, now you may not know about this race, and I don't know anything about it, Hans, other than what I heard in the early stages. There was a race in New Mexico where, and even the name of the person escapes me in this moment, but they were concerned about voter fraud. There she won, and then there is supposed to be some sort of a challenge of that. Do you know anything about that particular race?
No, I'm sorry, Sandy, I don't.
Okay, that was the person that won was supposed to be in the Freedom Caucus, and she won by, a comfortable lead, and now that's being challenged too. But New Mexico's kind of like, it really is a state, but we know, so it doesn't make the headlines very much, so I don't know about that state either. Is there any other thing, Hans, is there any way to sort this all out? Let's just pick Florida. Really, is there a way to sort this out?
No, what everyone should understand is that Florida illustrates the many security vulnerabilities that we have in our election system, from bad voter registration rolls and the easy ability of people who aren't eligible to vote, like non-citizens, to register to vote to not get caught, to the other problems that we have sometimes with the counting of ballots. And we tend to not notice or see those problems because most election victories are by large margins. And it's when the margin gets as narrow as it is many of the elections we've had last week, that's where those vulnerabilities could make the difference and change the outcome of an election.
Yeah, no question about it. So it's hard. It's discouraging. It's very discouraging, but we soldier on trying to make sure that things go right, and that's certainly what Hans does on behalf of the Heritage Foundation. He and Christian Adams are deeply involved in trying to set things right when it comes to voter integrity. Hans, thank you for joining us this morning. Please have safe travels, and we'll see you soon.
Thanks, Sandy.
Okay, all right. I'd like to end the show with something a little bit more uplifting. It is discouraging. You know, I was reading... actually, our pastor yesterday reminded me of a scripture I read recently, and that is in the old King James, it says, "Let us not be weary in well-doing, For if we continue to fight, we in due course at the proper time will reap fruit. And so I would just say that to you as I say it to myself. Don't be weary in well-doing. Don't be weary in trying to make sure that what's right is what happens in your own lives and also in public life. Well, Pete Davidson on Saturday Night Live was mocking Dan Crenshaw. Dan was my guest at Radio Row in D.C. A few months ago at Fair. He has a patch over his eye. He's a veteran. And by the way, he won his race in Texas just last week as to be a congressman. Pete Davidson on Saturday Night Live mocked him profusely. And so on Saturday Night Live on Saturday, Pete came on and said this.
And what I'm sure was a huge shock for people who know me, I made a poor choice last week. I did. I made a joke about Lieutenant Commander Dan Crenshaw. Dan Crenshaw, and on behalf of the show and myself, I apologize. My poor mom. Can
you imagine being my mom?
Can you imagine being my mom? That must suck. Can you imagine being Pete Davidson's mom? It can't be easy when everyone's mad at your son and roommate. No, but I mean this from the bottom of my heart. It was a poor choice of words. The man is a war hero, and he deserves all the respect in the world. And if any good came of this, maybe it was that for one day, the left and the right finally came together to agree on something. That I'm a dick.
You think?
Lieutenant Commander Dan Crenshaw, everyone, thank you so much for coming.
Thanks for making a Republican look good.
You gotta stop saying that, man. He's been saying it all day. Please. Look, I just wanted to say, for people that don't know, the reason you're wearing an eye patch right now is that you lost your eye to an IED in Afghanistan during your third combat tour. And I'm sorry.
Thank you, Pete. I appreciate you saying that.
So we good?
We're good. Apology accepted.
Just keep breathing.
It sounds like my phone's ringing. No, and I was just going to let it ring, because that's rude to answer. Let's just let it go to voicemail.
No, it's cool. Ariana Grande. Well, cool, man.
Yeah. What? Oh, do you know her?
All right, so that's funny. All right, so.
All right, the reason, the inside joke is Ariana Grande was singing that song, and Pete Davidson had a very painful breakup with her, so that's Dan, Lieutenant Commander, getting back at him. But he goes on, he's not finished, let's listen.
Last week, I made a joke about a picture of you, and I feel like it would only be fair if you got me back and made fun of a picture of me. Does that sound okay?
I don't really need to do that.
No, come on, I deserve it.
All right, I'll do it.
Please?
One.
All right.
And now, first impressions with Lieutenant Commander Dan Crenshaw.
Thanks, Colin. This is Pete Davidson. He looks like if the meth from Breaking Bad was a person.
Not bad. So there, we're even. All right.
Hold on. Well, one more. This is.
All right.
He looks like a troll doll with a tapeworm.
Yeah, man. All right, that's good. We should wrap this up.
Oh, hold on. No, this is fun. This is fun.
Cool.
He looks like Martin Short in the Santa Claus 3. By the way, one of these people was actually good on SNL.
Oh. No, you're right. No, you're not wrong.
Okay, but seriously, there's a lot of lessons to learn here. Not just that the left and right can still agree on some things, but also this, Americans can forgive one another. We can remember what brings us together as a country and still see the good in each other. This is Veterans Day weekend, which means that it's a good time for every American to connect with a veteran. Maybe say thanks for your service, but I would actually encourage you to say something else. Tell a veteran, never forget. When you say never forget to a veteran, you are implying that as an American, you are in it with them, not separated by some imaginary barrier between civilians and veterans.
Lieutenant Commander Dan Crenshaw, who will now be a congressman, and what a sweet moment of reconciliation. Sandy Rios in the morning.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.